Well, that's an appropriate herald, I think. Wake-up call, because today is a special day. I'm holding in my hands the heftier tactics copy here. 10th anniversary edition, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions. I'm very excited about this. 40% larger than the old one. And today is the launch day, November 26, 2019. And just looking at the progress a little bit on Amazon, it's number two in Christian books at the moment. And I guess that must be a separate category from apologetics, because it's four in apologetics, but number two in Christian books. Don't they consider apologetics books to be Christian books? Okay, I don't know. It's like they're different categories or however that goes. Anyway, it's nice to see it at the top of its rankings and also in evangelism, etc. Very nice launch today. And just in case you're not clear on this, is that that same old tactics book? And the answer is yes and no. That is, it is yes. It is the same book in the sense that it's the tactics book that you might know and love with Columbo and Steamroller and Just the Facts, Ma'am, and Suicide and Rhodes Scholar, et cetera, but what I did is I started at the beginning and I went through the whole thing to improve what's there and to add more. So this book, even the standard chapters where I didn't really change them much, I've expanded on them. And sometimes the expansion was so significant that I was able to take portions out and make whole new chapters on them. So defending against Columbo is not in the chapter it used to be in. It's its own chapter now because I expanded it considerably in light of the fact that that atheist Peter Boghossian has written a manual, a tactics manual, to train atheists to go after Christians and upend them with his questions. And so how do you deal with that? Well, I talk about that in the book. So there's an example of taking something already there and expanding it. I've reworked all the language in 10 years. I've learned some things, I think, about writing. It's it flows better. But there are a lot of things that I talk about now that I didn't talk about much back when I first wrote this book. The idea that the game plan rests upon a predicate of a different way of looking at the project that we call evangelism is something I touched on briefly in the first edition, but now I expand on a little bit more. And I make the distinction there, and some of you who have heard me talk about this recently know that I make the distinction between a harvesting approach and what you might call a gardening approach. Because before there can be any harvest, there always has to be a season of gardening. Virtually nobody comes to Christ, bang, just like that. Oh, there's the gospel. All right. Bend my knee, beat my breast, pray the prayer, and I'm in. Doesn't happen. Not nowadays. Almost ever. It's always been the case that there has been a season in people's lives before the harvest, a season of gardening, but now that season is much longer than it's ever been before because of the hostility of the culture to Christianity. And so, consequently, I've expanded that material to help people understand we're not swinging for the fences here. Never were. But now I'm underscoring that more than ever. We are not even trying to get on base. Never were. We're just trying to get into the batter's box. That's it. And the game plan allows you to do that in a very comfortable and effective fashion. And once you're in the batter's box, things begin to happen. Well, wasn't that the same before? Of course it was the same before, but a lot of people didn't want to get into the batter's box because they thought they were expected to hit a home run. Get them to sign on the dotted line, you know, close the deal, go for the gold, however you want to put it. But my strong encouragement is don't worry about that out of the gates. Don't be thinking about the end game. In fact, when you think about a sports game, right? Or let's say Super Bowl. The team has been working out for a long time. They've been strategizing for a long time. They've been working on their playbook for a long time. They're ready to win the Super Bowl. But when they get out and that first the ball is first kicked, those guys are not thinking about the end of the game. They have to get through the game first, and there's not going to be a good end of the game unless they have a good beginning and middle and then towards the end. In other words, they're executing individual plays effectively. You think about what you're doing in the moment. And that's my point, and I developed this in more thoroughness in this book, the idea that what we're going to do is we're going to go out and just try to put a stone in someone's shoe. We are going to do some gardening, and we're going to let God worry about the big process. We're just going to do a little. Now, it may mean that we can do more, all right, but we don't have to commit ourselves to do more. And I'll tell you a secret. When I look at the faces of people in the audience, when I develop this point, and it actually happened a couple of times over the weekend, actually three times, because I was in San Diego at ETS, and I was at a dinner that William Lane Craig had for his leadership there at Reasonable Faith. I was at a special apologetics leadership meeting with leaders from RZIM and from Reasonable Faith. I think some of those were there. I think RTB, Reasons to Believe, Stand to Reason team was there, and a number of other apologetics concerns that were represented there, and I got to speak the same thing to them. And then the next day, Saturday, I gave a presentation at the conference, the apologetics conference. And I'll tell you, when I get to the point of talking about the idea of gardening as opposed to harvesting, and by the way, I'm not opposed to harvesting, but the gardening comes first. And I want people to get out there and garden, because if we garden well, the harvest takes care of itself. And when I help people to see that particular point, and even tell them, by the way, that I have not led someone to Christ in probably 35 years. What a loser! No, 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 no. I'm not a harvester. I'm a gardener. And I will tell you, as I did the audience the other day, there's this guy named J. Warner Wallace. You ever heard of that guy? Well, it turns out Jim was listening to this program when he was still an atheist. There's a guy named Abdu Murray. You know that Muslim who became a Christian and wrote a few books and worked for RZIM as a speaker and is now in charge of speakers and, in fact, the senior vice president over at Ravi Zacharias International Ministry. Ever hear of Abdu? Abdu was listening to this broadcast when he was still a Muslim. In other words, these two guys were in my garden, and somebody else harvested the fruit out of my garden. Get out of my garden. You think I care? No. Jesus said in John 4, so that the one who reaps and the one who sows can rejoice together. So I rejoice with those who harvested, those people who were in my garden after a fashion. I got to garden them. That's all right. And there are a lot more like that. All right. By the way, and my point here is just saying that when people see this and I see their faces in the audience, I see the look that says, oh my gosh, I could do that. And that is a key to get them off the bench and into play, like into the batter's box. All right. So all that to say, there's more of that kind of stuff in the new edition. I spend more time developing that. And just like I expanded on the notion of gardening and harvesting to bring it more up to speed with the way I communicate these things now and the things that encourage people more than ever before, I have a bunch of other things that I've done with the Colombo tactic and some of the other tactics that are improvements on those tactics. But I've also got a whole new section. I've got actually six new chapters, and I have a whole chapter devoted to a new tactic called Inside Out. It's a great insight that is captured in that chapter that I got from Francis Schaeffer that makes a huge difference in the way that I approach my engagements with others who don't share my convictions. And there's a chapter called Mini Tactics, where I think there's either five or six maneuvers that are fairly simple to explain and to exemplify with real life examples that I've had. So you get the grasp that, for example, what a friend we have in Jesus. Sometimes it's better to let Jesus do your fighting for you. So if there's a controversial claim about Christianity and Jesus was the one who made it, but people are beating up on you for that, like Jesus being the only way, you might just point out, hey, man, this isn't my idea. This is Jesus' idea. He said it many times. He taught all of his followers who spoke after him the same thing, and they said the same thing. So do you think Jesus was wrong on this? Notice that question at the end. So what am I doing? I'm using what a friend we have in Jesus to leverage it against people who already think Jesus is pretty cool, even if they don't think I'm pretty cool. So let Jesus do the arguing for you. Now, there's a mini tactic, and you can use it in lots of different situations, but that's just one example. So I've got, five mini tactics, I think? And I've got a whole chapter to Inside Out, and I've reworked all the rest of the stuff. So just let you know. Incidentally, if this, we're coming up on the end of year, so December, when's December 1st? What is today? 25th? Next week? Early next week? Wednesday? Something like that. Okay, so that's our final month for the year for us in terms of our bookkeeping. And it's a time when we really have a huge emphasis on ending well. And it's a time that we come to you and unabashedly and unashamedly ask you to give above and beyond what you usually give if you don't give. And if you don't give, to give. On one condition, that what we do benefits you. If what we do benefits you, then it's appropriate for you to respond to help us continue doing what we do for you and for others. And so that's the idea. It's down to reason. Our policy from the very beginning is we never ask to receive until we've given first, and we'll keep giving. God willing, if you have been the beneficiary of the team's efforts en masse, whether it's the show or the website or speaking or books or materials of any kind, we'd love to have a thank you from you. And this year, just like in the last 4 or 5 years, we've had a challenge. That means we've had a group of donors that have gotten together and pledged $246,200 to be exact. So we're pretty close to $250,000. And they say, look, we're pledging this. We're going to give you this. In fact, a lot of those have already given, but we're offering it as a challenge to the rest to say, step up and in aggregate match our challenge gift. So this is the biggest challenge gift we've had. Almost $250,000, but we're just challenging you along with them to step up. And if you do, and you send a gift before December 31st, you're going to get a copy of the revised and expanded 10th anniversary edition of Tactics. All right, we're just going to send it to you. In fact, you're going to get a signed copy. I spent a while signing it. There's Kyle. He's giving me the thumbs up. Poor Kyle. I pressed him into service the other day with cranking books out of the boxes and opening it to the right page so I can, get a signature every 5 seconds with his help. Made the whole thing go faster. And I'm going to have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these to sign. I already done about 400. But we've got a lot more because I know many of you are going to take advantage of this opportunity to not only help us and to say thank you for what we've done for you this year, but we can also say thank you for your gift by sending you a copy of the new and improved and expanded Tactics in Defending Your Faith, the 10th Anniversary Edition. So that launches today. Oh, you know what? I wanted to ask you one other thing about that. Actually, more than one other thing, but I wonder if you could do me a favor. The problem with Amazon, which is where most people sell books, now, we want you to buy the book from us, all right? Just go to our website, str.org, if you're going to buy it, or just send a gift and we'll give it to you, okay? However, Amazon is where everybody else looks. Now, the first edition had over 600 reviews, and almost 90% of them were 5 stars. So I had like over 525 five-star reviews that are now all gone. Well, they're still there with the first edition, but the second edition comes up, and that's the main player right now, and there's no reviews, or now there are just a couple of them coming up. So here's my request. If you read the first edition and haven't gotten the second edition yet, but love the first edition, I promise you, if you gave the first one 5 stars, you're going to give the second one 5 stars plus. Actually, you can't do that on Amazon, but it's a better book, just saying. So it would do me a big favor if you went onto Amazon and weighed in. And while you're there, if you see another 5-star review that you read and you like, say it was helpful. Okay, if it was. Because that's how they decide which reviews go to the top. And I'd like to have a lot of 5-star reviews, front and center when people open that page. So I'm not telling you to do anything you wouldn't do naturally. I mean, if you don't like the review, don't say it was helpful. But it's a way of weighing in with your point of view and also helping me as well. Okay, so you might also want to post a quick tweet or a note or something like that on Twitter or on Facebook or Instagram with the link to the Standard Reason site where the people can buy the book and say, look, I read this book. It was great for me, if it was. And, yeah, I recommend it to you, too. So those are all ways that you'd help us on this day of the launch of the second edition, 10th anniversary edition, of the updated and expanded tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions. So thank you so much. Let's see. Probably we got some people on board that would like to talk to me, so maybe we'll take a break here and I'll get to calls. Stay with us on Standard Reason.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
What does a silo of soybeans or an old 1987 Nissan truck have to do with apologetics? When donated, both enabled STR to provide Christians like you with the resources you need to gain confidence in defending your faith. STR's partnership with iDonate makes donating non-cash items easy. You can give personal items like vehicles, stock, jewelry, gift cards, and more. iDonate takes care of selling the items and gives the cash proceeds to STR. So if you're looking for a unique way to support the work of Stand to Reason, consider donating that random gift card Aunt Bertha gave you last Christmas. Simply go to str.org/donate and click the link at the bottom of the page.
All right. Back at you here, Greg Kokol and Stand to Reason, giving you a piece of my mind today. As I do most Tuesdays from 4 to 6, my number 562-424-8229. That 4 to 6 time. Thank you, Amy. She asked me if I needed my Bible. I thought, yeah, there's a couple of verses I haven't memorized yet somebody might ask me about. So she got me my big giant one that has all my notes in it. My notes, not the like study Bible notes, which are fine. I just have never migrated towards that. It might help me. But anyway, that number... 562-424-8. Oh, wait a minute. That's the wrong number. That's outside the United States, 8229. Local, if you're inside the U.S., most of you are, 855-243-9975. And the time would be 4 to 6 Los Angeles time, because that's what we're calling, we're broadcasting from on Tuesdays. And love to answer whatever questions that you have I can help you with in engaging the world, or if you're a skeptic or a critic, that's okay. You're welcome as well. Let's go to New York City and Joel. Hello, Joel. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg. How are you doing?
Doing all right, sir. I'm very excited about this day.
Yes, I actually got my copy in the mail today. I had pre-ordered it a couple months ago, and so I have my copy. Haven't begun reading it yet. I did read the first one, but I'm excited to read the second one now.
Well, good. You'll find a lot of new stuff that'll be helpful, I'm sure.
So my question actually is not an original in the sense that it's not from me. I've been listening through the archive and of your podcast, going back, but I started in 2004, whatever it is that you guys have on there. And I think I'm up to almost the end of 2009 at this point. But the question was asked to Brett. He had been filling into you, and he didn't really have an answer. And so he had said to call you the following week, but the guy never called back. So, needless to say,
I'm going to dock his pay. I don't think we pay him, but maybe we did. No, we didn't pay him, so can't do that. I'll charge him.
So, anyways, I'm curious to see if you have an answer to this question. It's an interesting one. It's just in reference to Mark 13:32 about where Jesus is talking about only the Father knows the day and the hour, and the idea being like, how do we deal with the Holy Spirit and His, at least I think most Christians would agree that he's supposed to be equal to God in all aspects, including omniscience.
Yeah, that would be a proper kind of, he's not equal to, he is God.
Right.
Ontologically the same God, so he shares the same divine characteristics, correct, as the Father does.
Yeah. So I don't know, and that's basically the question, like how do that, because that verse says, you know, Jesus obviously saying he doesn't know, and then he says, the NASB basically says only the Father alone.
Yeah, well,
so
you know, it's interesting.
To indicate that the, sorry.
Right, no, I get your question. I'm looking at my New American Standard here. I'll read verse 32. Of that day or hour, no one knows. That's present tense, and I have something to say about that in a moment. Not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but the Father. Oh, and then I have the word alone in italics. Do you know why it's in italics?
No.
Because it's not in the original. The translators put it in there because they think that it is implied. And so there's nothing wrong with that. It's not a complaint. And sometimes that fills out sentences that the Greek grammar does not adequately fill out for an English translation. Okay, if like, for example, verse 34, it is like a man away on a journey who, upon leaving his house, no, some of those words are in italics. So without the italicized, you would just read, like a man away on a journey upon leaving his house. So they put those other words in there to kind of make them more full sentences because they are the kind of thing that you would say if you were saying this in English. But what I wouldn't want to do is I wouldn't want to make a theological point hinge on one of those italicized words. So if what we read in 32, leaving the italicized out, but of that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but the Father. Okay, well, that means the Father knows, but the Son doesn't. Do you see, without putting the alone in there, it does leave open that the Holy Spirit would know. And
yes,
incidentally,
of course, I agree.
There is no reason to leave the Holy Spirit out of the omniscience equation, because he unlike the Son, is not in a an emptied state, so to speak. The theologians call it the kenosis, where the Son empties himself not of his divine attributes, but of his divine prerogatives. And so this is a little bit strange. How could Jesus be fully God, but his human nature doesn't know what his divine nature knows? I don't know how to answer that. But technically speaking, there in some things, the man Jesus, the human being Jesus, does not have full access to what the divine nature has access to. All right. So, and better theological men than me can make more sense of that. But that's one way of explaining how Jesus would not know. It's just, but we have no reason to believe that that applies to the Holy Spirit, because the Holy Spirit is not in a kenotic state, in an emptied state, a stepping down state. The concept of kenosis comes from the passage in Philippians where Paul says, chapter 2, that he did not regard equality with God as a thing to be grasped, but was willing to empty himself and come down to earth and become a servant and then die a death in our place, essentially. Holy Spirit, that's not his project. So the fullness of the divine nature is fully accessible to the Holy Spirit just as it is to the Father. So I don't think that when it says, nor the Son but the Father, that itself, even putting the alone in there, that is not meant to exclude the Holy Spirit, because then you have all kinds of additional problems theologically that would not make any sense, nor is there any need for those problems. In the Son, yes, because you have an incarnation, that is a unique circumstance, but not with the Spirit. Make sense?
So you would say, yeah, well, so you would say then that the Word, you kind of actually near the end maybe indicated you don't think this, but it seems to me that based on what you're saying, the Word alone actually is an unfortunate addition. Because I would interpret, as soon as that Word alone is in there, it seems to me that means the Father alone, meaning there's no one but the Father.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So
well,
that would exclude the Holy Spirit in that, if that was an accurate translation with that word.
Well, I wouldn't even read it that way. Even if you said the word alone is justifiable to put in there, even if it's in the original Greek, I do not think what the writer is intending to do is exclude the Spirit, okay? He is not saying in the Trinity only one member. In fact, the concept of the Trinity isn't even spelled out here, so the Spirit's not even in view. The contrast is between the angel, human beings, angels, and the Son. And none of those, only the Father. Only of those, the Father. That's what I think he's getting at. And if we go and we say, well, what the writer means, actually Jesus here, what he means to be communicating is the Holy Spirit doesn't know either, that creates a real problem. Because Holy Spirit could be divine and not have omniscience? Are you thinking, are you indicating
that, because I have always thought that when the scriptures talk about the Father, it means the person, the Father, but
yes.
Are you saying that the Father could also imply or indicate the Father and the Spirit?
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that there's a you have to read these all inclusive language or all exclusive language, like all or none or alone in this case. You have to keep in mind the frame of reference. So when I said, gee, I had a birthday party the other day and everyone was there, what, 9 billion people? No, all of my friends were there for the most part. So you have a frame of reference that your language is dealing with. And I think that in this particular case, the Father alone means, in the reference of angels and the Son and us, that only the Father has the knowledge, not those others in the sentence. So the frame of reference does not include the Holy Spirit at all. It's not even referring to that. So I'm not saying the Father means the Father and the Spirit. I'm saying that that Jesus is only making reference to a smaller set, that is human beings and the Son and angels, etc. The Father knows, the Father alone, of those. It doesn't necessarily exclude the Holy Spirit. I think there would be problems if it did.
Oh, okay. I think I understand now. It just clicked what you're saying. I wasn't getting it up to that point, but okay. So you're basically saying that...
Mm-hmm.
He's saying that out of these three people, if you will, this person alone knows, but that doesn't necessarily exclude there might be a person outside that set.
Well, if you're talking about the person of the Spirit, yes, but it's meant
right.
to be excluding all these other sources, other people, agents, subjects, basically. And I'm trying to think of another illustration. And I might say, I go on a fishing trip, you know, and I go with a bunch of my apologetics buddies or they say, did your brothers go with you? No, it was just me alone or something like that. It might mean that regarding the Coco Clan boys, no, I was the only one. Now, that doesn't mean I didn't have my daughter with me or I didn't have my wife with me. We were talking about something different when I meant to exclude right. them and identify me as alone. That's what I mean by frame of reference, all right?
I understand now. That makes
okay.
sense.
One other thing that I want to point out is that, and I think this is significant, Mark 13, and also you see this in Matthew 24, because you have this is a parallel passage with the Olivet Discourse, right? Yeah. Okay, so, and he says here that no one knows. That's present tense. He doesn't say no one will ever know. He is responding to a question at that time in the Matthew 24. When will these things be, and when will your coming be? And he says, no one knows the specific time, not even the Son, but the Father alone. So my question is, do you think Jesus now, next to the Father in his exalted state, does he know? And if he, I think he does.
I do, yeah.
Yeah, well then this restricted knowledge passage doesn't apply anymore because it was only talking about what was available at that moment. This this understanding, by the way, trades affects some doctrine about eschatology. And some say, well, since no one knows, they mean no one will ever know, that means Jesus could appear any split second. And I don't think that's what it means.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's like no extra charge. That one.
Yeah.
Just
yeah,
a little
reflection. I agree with that point, of course.
Yeah.
So.
All right,
Greg, thank you so much, and have a great Thanksgiving.
Yeah, you too. All the best to you, Joel.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Yeah,
bye.
Appreciate that. All right, let's look at what we got here. Is this Michael? Yeah, okay. Michael in Santa Fe Springs, California. Welcome, sir.
Hey, Greg. Happy almost Thanksgiving.
Yeah, that's right. It's amazing. It's only 2 days away. My goodness.
I know.
You know what happened is my wonderful staff made an unbelievable cake for me. And I honestly, I had no expectation anything was going to happen. But because today is the book launch day, they made a cake that looks just like the book. I mean, it's all edible, but it's almost like a photograph of the book's cover. I don't know how they do this. CNC or something, I don't know, but they, and so then we had, it was like 4 inches thick or five maybe, it was huge, and then I thought, what am I going to do with all this extra cake, because it's about half still left, and then I realized, hey, I can take it to my brother's for Thanksgiving, and that'll be part of our dessert, so of course, it's all cut up now, you don't quite, my name's gone because I ate it. But anyway, so that's Thanksgiving coming up.
Yes, definitely. Congrats on the book. I'm looking forward to reading it. Love the first one.
Thank you. Please, if you like it or liked it, please take a moment and tell people on Amazon. I'd really appreciate that.
I was just thinking about that earlier. So, yep, you got it. All right, well, let me get to the question real quick. So right now it is currently open enrollment again when it comes to like health insurance season. And so I've been thinking a lot about health insurance lately, and I've come to realize that all the options that are available to me in California for health insurance are sponsoring companies and policies that include things like paying for abortions and stuff like that.
Right.
And so I'm wondering about the ethics of choosing any of these options, or if it would be almost obligatory for me to try and pursue some alternative form of health care, like mm-hmm. A Christian health care sharing ministry or something.
Mm-hmm.
And if it relates at all to Tostison, I was wondering if a similar principle would apply at all in thinking about the world of investing, you know, looking about like different investments you can do and stuff. So
right.
I don't know if those things are actually connected, but I thought I'd call you up and see what you thought.
Yeah, they sometimes, there's a term for that, like ethical investing, but there's a term for investing in funds that don't have anything to do with alcohol or tobacco or things that might, in some people's theology, be questionable. So in any event, the key word there in your question was obligatory. I've actually been answering questions like this since my earliest days in radio. And I early on, I came to the conclusion that that we are not morally responsible for how an organization we do business spends their money. And if we were morally responsible, it's hard to imagine hardly any organization that doesn't spend some of its money in some kind of enterprise that we would consider to be ethically questionable. All right, whether it's donating or whether it's spending whatever, you know. And so we couldn't, realistically, we are not strapped with that because we can't have anything to, we have nothing to say about how people spend the money that they get from us when we do business with them. Okay.
Okay.
So as far as the strict ethical obligation portion of the question, I think, no, we're not ethically obligated. Now, having said that, though, there's another factor, and the factor is your personal comfort level, ethical comfort level, and conscience. I think that what I offered you was sound ethical advice, that responsibility for behaviors don't transfer over to people that have done business with you. Okay. However, you might want to say, you know what, it makes me feel like my hands are dirty because I'm messing around with this group that does these other things. And I don't like that. I don't even want to get close to that. And my response is more power to you. If you don't like it, you don't have to do it. So there could be an individual comfort level or even an individual ethical level in that you might say, well, you know, Greg, I heard what you said, but I don't know. In some cases, that might be okay. But in this case, I just don't see it. I just feel like it's a wrong thing. And my response is, all right, then, don't do it. Follow your conscience in this situation and withhold activity. Now, that means you might have to find some other alternative, obviously, for health care. And there are Christian organizations that have special kind of pools or funds that you all contribute to and help each other out. And generally, you save a lot of money in a situation like that. But also, generally, you can't drink or smoke in any way and still qualify for that thing. So there's a little bit of a speed bump for some people. But that's an alternative. I think that's fine. The only other factor is, even if one knows that there is no moral concern with doing business with a company, a person may make a choice just simply based on trying to make a statement that they're not going to do business with that company anymore. And so, there's this recent flap. I don't have time to talk about it right now, but Chick-fil-A, and Chick-fil-A adjusting their giving in a very public way that seems to be a concession to the LGBT crowd. There's very good evidence that that's the case. Well, a lot of Christians are disappointed in the decision they made, and they may just say, okay, I'm not buying any of your chicken. And I'm just going to go to Big Mac or something else. Now, Big Mac's not a more moral organization, McDonald's. However, it's a way of making a statement to Dan Cathy and the crowd over there at Chick-fil-A that you are not approving of the decision they just made. Frankly, I wish they rescind it and go back to the Salvation Army in spades and quit supporting these other organizations that have kinship with the LGBT crowd. That's another issue, and maybe next week I'll talk about that. But notice that there's a category there of saying, I'm not going to do business because you give money, but it's not because I think it's immoral. It's because I want to spank you a little bit.
Right, yeah. Well, I totally get everything you're saying there, and I agree that we could drive ourselves insane if we had to fully research every single company we bought something from, and yeah, it's a slippery slope. But maybe you can help me with just a general principle of ethics. The reason why I said obligatory is because I'm trying to discern if there's a category of, like, if you can think of one option that, let's say, is morally neutral and another option that is morally good, I don't know, then are you obligated to take the morally better option, if that makes any sense?
No, I don't think so. And this would fall in a category of what's called a supererogatory act. Now, that's a fancy philosophical word in ethics that just simply means going above and beyond the call of duty. Supererogatory acts are acts that are not morally required, but they are morally commendable if done. So the classic example is an act of heroism. People who do genuine acts of heroism, those actions most people would acknowledge you're not obliged to do. We would all understand if you didn't run into that burning building. It's not wrong not to run in there, okay? But you did it, and you went above and beyond the call, and therefore, because you did that, you should be applauded for doing that. Now, if you have to go back to your illustration, and you have one that's morally neutral and one that's morally good, I don't think you're obliged to do the morally good one, that where you can bring some positive moral benefit. But if you wanted to do it, especially if it meant as a sacrifice to you, you certainly have that choice you could make. And that would be an example of a heroic, so to speak, or supererogatory act.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. I really appreciate your help, Greg.
Yeah. I'm glad to talk to you here, Mike, and have a great Thanksgiving, okay?
Hey, you as well. God bless.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye now. All right, let's look at what we got here. I guess it's time for a break, huh? All right, let's do that. And then we'll come back to Tracy in Tennessee and whoever else is on board on Stand to Reason.
Would you like Greg, Alan, or Tim to come speak at a location near you? If so, just send a quick email to darcy@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers are accomplished and compelling presenters who address, from a biblical standpoint, topics like abortion, homosexuality, and evolution, as well as apologetics, theology, and evangelism. They're available to teach lectures and seminars, preach sermons, and lead workshops at single events or weekend-long conferences. Their aim is to help Christians like you effectively engage the culture around you with knowledge, wisdom, and character. To learn more, just go to str.org and click on the training tab at the top of the page.
Are you looking for a way to be more involved in the STR community? When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group helping STR-trained Christians to graciously defend classical Christianity and classical Christian values. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our planning and ongoing work. As a strategic partner, you'll enjoy an automatic 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and bi-monthly insider updates, so you'll get the inside scoop on what's going on in the ministry, and you'll know what you can pray for. Become a strategic partner in the Stand to Reason community today by visiting str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate and choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email ocean@str.org. That's ocean@str.org.
All righty. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason. Mind implants without brain surgery performed here every Tuesday. How about that? You like that? Haven't said that in a while. All right, let's go to Tennessee and Tracy. Hello, Tracy.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're a cheerful sort today, or tonight for you.
Yes, tonight. Getting the kiddos in the bed here in a minute.
Yeah, I'm glad that you called. Thank you, Tracy.
Well, my question has a specific backstory, but I'm looking for guidance on reaching ex-Christians. You know, they know the gospel, they've been baptized, they think, yeah, Christianity, been there, done that. I have recently reached out to an old friend who grew up in an evangelical church, but she abandoned her faith about 5 years ago, and I think what happened was she had doubts that she never voiced to anybody, and then she found Richard Dawkins, and his explanations of evolution and such just made sense to her. So she identifies now as an atheist, and I think a materialist. She doesn't believe in anything supernatural, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand, you know, the harvest is a long way off for her, but I do want to do some gardening and keep tending to it. I've had 2 conversations with her so far and asked her lots of questions about, you know, what do you mean by that? You know,
sure.
Explain your position on this.
Good for you.
And what led her to feel that way, and try to let her do most of the talking so I can understand where the minefields and, you know, at the end of our last conversation, she apologized for not being very eloquent with, presenting her view. And so I said, oh, no problem. You know, maybe next time we talk, I'll be the one who's not eloquent. And I can tell you where I stand if you're interested. And she said that would be fine. So now it's, now what?
I see. Okay, good. Well, this is excellent. And you had a great start. And what you've done is you've drawn the other person out in a generous way to give you a good, much better idea where she's at. And now she's inviting you to do the same thing. I mean, this is, oh man, what a country. What's not to love here? So, and I like that you, that you've began with the questions. And I mean, some of the things that occurred to me, I have some thoughts about where you go from here, but I just want to underscore some of the things that you did. When people say who are former Christians, been there, done that, I'm not entirely sure what the there is and the that is. Now, I know they mean, oh, I tried Christianity, but I'm wondering, and this may not apply to your circumstances, broader for the rest of the audience, I'm wondering when people said, I've tried Christianity, what do you mean you tried Christianity? When you get to the details of those kind of things, it may be that people had experiences with decidedly non-Christian Christians. That is, people who are broadly in Christendom and identify as Christians, but don't really believe or live like like Jesus. They don't believe like Jesus. They don't live like Jesus. So, you know, that could be a problem. A lot of times people experience nominal Christianity growing up or legalistic Christianity or weird Christianity growing up, and then they head out the door figuring that they already tried that, let me try something else, maybe atheism. That was my own story, by the way. I was raised Roman Catholic, though I never became an atheist. I did come to the conviction that I didn't believe in Roman Catholicism, and when I left that, I left what I understood to be Christianity. And it wasn't until 6 years later that I came back around with a different understanding of what Christianity was than I had learned as a Roman Catholic. And by the way, the Vatican I tradition, not Vatican II tradition. So that's one thing. You've been there, done that. What was the there and what was the that? That's an important question to draw out of people. I'm also curious, and again, I'm just helping, this general things I'm thinking about here from what you told me. I'm also curious about a person who left Christianity because they read Richard Dawkins. What is it that Richard Dawkins stands for or taught her or convinced her of that made her think that Christianity is false? And if it's just the evolution thing, Christianity isn't false because Darwinian evolution is true. That's kind of a misstep. Now, I don't think Darwinian evolution is true, and maybe it's in the next hour I'll talk about that. But in principle, what makes Christianity true or false is not how living things developed over time, but whether Jesus was a real individual and did what the historical accounts claim he did, and whether he rose from the dead. That's the central feature. And I know that Dawkins is a big fan of evolution, obviously, but the evolution issue by itself does not falsify Christianity. In fact, there are a lot of Christians who believe in evolution, I think mistakenly, but that doesn't falsify their Christianity in and of itself, seems to me. So
I think for her, I think Christianity lost its appeal and no longer looked attractive to her.
Huh.
And so it wasn't necessarily based on evidence that brought her away. I think it just no longer looked attractive.
Go ahead. No. I was going to, you started to say what I mean by that. Yes, and that's what I was going to ask you.
When I asked her specifically what doubts it was that she had that she never voiced to anybody, she said, you know, she grew up in a kind of a split home. Her mother was a Christian. Her father was not. They were still living together. And her mother put the pressure on her as a child to convert the father. And it, you know, she was required to ask the father every week, will you come to church with us? No. Will you come to church with us? No. And so to her, how could a good God send her nice dad, who's a good person, who just doesn't go to church, how can he send him to hell? And, you know, the problems of evil is a problem for her. You know, some of those types of questions.
Yeah. By the way, the problem of evil is a much bigger problem for atheists than it is for Christians, but it's another issue. Just to think about that, because if she's now an atheist and following Richard Dawkins, Richard Dawkins says there's no evil, there's no good, there is just nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. That's atheism. So if you look at what you think is the problem of evil in the world and become an atheist, then what your alternative is to say there is no evil and there's no good, just blind, pitiless indifference. He famously said that, and that's very consistent with atheism. So if that doesn't get rid of the problem of evil, it basically denies it, one of the most salient features of reality, that something is wrong with everything. So that's what I mean. It's a bigger problem for the atheist. Okay, so let me get to the heart of your question to me, though, is where do you start? Now, it's a little hard for me to tell you where to start with your story. A lot depends on you. If it were me, and what they're asking me is where did you start, and it's biographical, then I start with my biography. That is my spiritual biography, and I talk about that. If they mean what's the story, that is, what is the story of reality, to coin a phrase, how does this all fit together from your perspective? Well, then I would start in a different place. I'd start at the beginning. Our story starts in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Well, that's consistent with Richard Dawkins's science. And his science says the universe came into existence at a point, a singularity called that we call the Big Bang. But the legitimate question is, what caused the Big Bang? And now Dawkins was going to say, well, nothing caused it because there was nothing there to cause it. But doesn't that strike someone as counterintuitive? It seems to me a better explanation for the way things are is that the Big Bang was caused by an uncaused being. And if you say uncaused being, you escape the problem of saying, well, who created God, kind of thing.
Right.
Which Dawkins does that. And now that gives you an origin for the universe, which is contingent based on something that is not contingent, God, who is uncaused and self-existent. Well, that makes perfect sense. There's no glitches in that. But to say that, you know, everything came from nothing, no thing caused the universe. It was uncaused. This is like not the odds-on favorite, right? And so if I were to tell my story, I'd say there's that. And then he made human beings a certain way. Human beings are special. And by the way, we all know this. Everybody knows this. This is why it's wrong to, you can gas termites, but not Jews. Right? I mean, to put it bluntly. Well, why not? Because human beings are not termites. We're not bugs. Oh, really? On Dawkins's view, there's no difference. Now, he can protest all he wants, but at the heart of it, there's no difference. Okay? Now, does this still look, this is blind, pitiless indifference, right? Does that look appealing? And when I say appealing, I don't mean does it look like something you like. I mean, does it resonate with your deep intuitions about the way the world is? And then we have a world that, gosh, it's really looks like it's designed. The biological realm is thick with information on the DNA double helix. The cosmological realm has these fine-tuned constants that are just unbelievably refined. And what does Richard Dawkins says? Oh, we got lucky. I'm not making that
right
up. So why is we got lucky a better explanation than design? You wouldn't throw a coin. You wouldn't even look at a footprint in the sand and say, well, it kind of got lucky. It just looks like that by accident, wind and waves and erosion or something like that. It looks like a perfect number 10 foot. Oh, yeah. Got lucky. Well, who would believe that? So basically, the general approach here that I'm suggesting is that if you're going to tell the story rather than your story, and I'm not sure what mm-hmm. her question entails, if you're going to tell the story, then what you're broadly trying to offer is the best explanation for the way things are. We have the origin of the universe. Sorry?
Got it. Yeah.
Okay. We have the origin of the universe. Okay. Dawkins agrees with that. We agree with that. He thinks it was not caused, which is contrary to every experience of every human being of every event virtually in the world, with the possible exception of some quantum events. But even that's questionable. But we're not talking about some quantum, some subatomic particle. We're talking about the whole thing, the whole universe. Then we have this incredible design. And what Dawkins wants to say, well, it's not because of a designer in the chemistry of the world or the physics of the world. It's because we got lucky. And mm-hmm. then he wants to say, and in biology, it's because of, you know, the blind watchmaker. But there's all kinds of problems with that, with the idea of where did the information come from, and that is responsible for the details of the biological realm. So in each of these really important areas, Dawkins has one answer and we have another answer. Dawkins' answer is wildly counterintuitive in every single case, because he'd say that the universe came from nothing, that life came from non-life, that consciousness mm-hmm. came from matter, right? Really?
Right.
That morality doesn't exist at all in the deep sense. It's just a trick of evolution. Oh, really? Does that sound like the best answer? I think those are terrible answers. But the answers that are given by us in Christianity are ones that seem to fit the circumstances, and they, what I would say, are much better, not just better explanations, but the odds on favorite. And this is really critical, last thought here, Tracy, because we're almost out of time. It resonates with our deepest intuitions about the way things are, what reality is actually like. And so that's the way I would approach this if you're going to tell the story. By the way, you might take a look at The Story of Reality, which is a book I wrote meant to describe that story. And a lot of what I've said is in there, but which account of reality fits reality best? That's what we're after, and that might help. Tracy, call me back sometime in a few weeks after you've had some conversation with your friend. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. You go out and give them heaven, my friends. Bye-bye now.